With regard to external sources of modernity, Paulistas could point to their state's unparalleled success in whitening its population by attracting large numbers of European immigrants. However, Paulista elites hardly wanted to cede all credit for São Paulo's progress to the immigrant masses, many of whom shown an unfortunate inclination towards such indisputably modern ideologies as anarchism and socialism. Instead, they highlighted the second potential source of modernity, the idiosyncratic nature of São Paulo's colonial experience, deployed to explain the region's singular aptitude for and receptivity to modernity. Again, the foundational myth for this cultural representation was the saga of the Bandeirante. Now I will explain who the Bandeirante was for those of you who don't know. The Bandeiras were bands of men who had their home base in São Paulo and organized long-distance expeditions during the 17th and early 18th centuries to explore the Brazilian interior, largely in search of precious minerals to unearth and Indians to enslave. And of course, the members of these bandeiras were called bandeirantes. The bandeira was just the banner that they would use to identify themselves. It also means flag. In the black legend writings of Spanish missionaries, the Bandeirante is a cruel and unsavory character. And some, if any of you have seen the movie The Mission, there's an opening scene where Indians are being slaughtered, Guarani Indians are being slaughtered by Portuguese-speaking men, and they're Bandeirantes. But in the hands of early 20th century Paulista regionalists, he is recast as a proto-capitalist entrepreneur. In contrast to the parasitical, decadent, and tradition-bound sugar planter, the Bandeirante is enterprising, risk-taking, and industrious. Moreover, it was the Bandeiras, by intrepidly exploring the furthest reaches of the Brazilian interior, that guaranteed the capacious boundaries of the future Brazilian nation. Finally, being men from a virile culture, and they're always referred to as virile, the Bandeirantes could absorb the positive traits of exotic elements, such as the Indians, because many of the Bandeirantes were in fact mestizos, that is part Indian, without losing their essential, i.e. European, characteristics. What these self-congratulatory paeans to São Paulo's exceptionalism routinely suppressed was the crucial post-colonial interlude of plantation slavery. Indeed, one could read popular and scholarly accounts of São Paulo's history from this era and entirely miss the fact that the region had been for several decades in the second half of the 19th century, Brazil's most important slave plantation economy, with one of the largest African populations in the nation. When acknowledged at all, this uncomfortable fact was papered over with the assertion that Paulista planters demonstrated a progressive disposition that made them eager to adopt new techniques and reluctant to rely on slaves. Thus, many planters, it was claimed, became active abolitionists. A few did. Anxious to make the transition to free, and as it turns out, white labor. In sum, not only was the Paulista not a typical slave-owning planter, but he even played a crucial role in abolishing slavery and modernizing agriculture. As for the eventual racial composition of São Paulo, the noted folklorist Dalmo Belforte de Matos assured his readers in the 1930s that São Paulo had been predominantly white during the colonial period. He claimed 3-1, 3 whites to 1 non-white, a figure that I'm sure he just pulled out of the air. And while he grudgingly admitted that people of color temporarily became a majority during the first phase of the coffee boom, quote, this soon passed. Mortality and race mixture gradually eliminated the African excess, unquote. So, I mean, here's a perfect example. I mean, obviously, there were still many people in São Paulo of African descent. But the way he's presenting São Paulo's population is a population where even if there are some African descended people left, they are just a very small portion of the Paulista population. The Bandeirante saga was not the only ingredient tossed into the brew of Paulista identity. The Brazilian historian Tanya de Luca notes that Paulista essayists even claimed linguistic superiority for their home region. They claimed that Portuguese spoken in Rio was a Portuguese that was too similar to Portugal's Portuguese, and that only in São Paulo did they speak a Portuguese that was a genuinely Brazilian Portuguese. But this Bandeirante saga was especially crucial in that it provided a historical foundation for São Paulo's claims to national superiority. In 19th century Latin America, according to the literary theorist Doris Sommer, the nascent publics in the newly independent nations turned to romantic novels as substitutes or supplements for histories that were yet to be written. But by the early 20th century, historical narratives were essential components of national and regional identities. And like the novels, the Bandeirante saga had a genuinely popular appeal, both within and beyond the state of São Paulo. And again, it becomes so identified, the Bandeirante figure becomes so identified that the povo Bandeirante, the Bandeirante people, becomes a synonym widely used throughout Brazil for the povo Paulista, the Paulista people. Now, if the myth of the Bandeirante provided a master narrative to explain São Paulo's divergence from the rest of Brazil, the constitutionalist movement and the 1932 regional uprising against the federal government provided a hothouse environment in which ideas about Paulista superiority could flourish. And if you want to compare it to something within U.S. history, I mean, if you look at the U.S. South prior to the secession, the formation of the Confederacy and the secession, and clearly that's in a context in which there's an enormous amount of discussion about Southern, a kind of proto-national Southern identity. And so this is also a period when São Paulo is in conflict with the federal government, and there's an enormous outpouring of articles, poetry, novels, chronicles, arguing that about, you know, both how and why Paulistas are different from other Brazilians. Most of the historical literature on the revolution of 1932, as it's often called, although again it's kind of more of a brief civil war, focuses on the questions of causes, with the explanation usually being found in the resentment of the Paulista elite at being unceremoniously dislodged from national dominance by Getúlio Vargas's seizure of power in 1930. So, very quick summary. Basically, for most of the period of what was called the Old Republic in Brazil, from 1889 to 1930, the Paulista elite was really the dominant political elite. Although its fortunes were not consistent, they tended to dominate the political sector. In 1930, Getúlio Vargas, who's from the far south of Brazil and with support of the military, seizes power and declares himself president / dictator of Brazil. And the state of São Paulo at first kind of accepts certain segments of the political elite accepts his government, but then he imposes an outsider, that is a non-Paulista, as governor of São Paulo, and that begins a movement against him that takes, you know, regains more and more momentum and finally leads to the outbreak of civil war in the middle of 1932. My point here is not so much to discuss the causes of the war, that is why the revolt occurred, but more how it occurred. For me, the most interesting question is how the Paulista elite managed to mobilize a diverse and substantial portion of the Paulista population to take up arms against the federal government. This was, after all, a state that had no history of regional uprisings. Moreover, the last uprising of this type in Brazil had occurred in the 1890s, 40 years earlier. São Paulo's revolt was the only noteworthy regional challenge to the power of Brazil's central government in the 20th century. What is significant then is not just the specific grievances, genuine or spurious, motivating the revolt, but how its leaders and supporters came to decide that it was legitimate for Paulistas to take up arms against the Brazilian state. As is probably already apparent, I would locate the roots of that decision in the discourse of Paulista superiority that long preceded the 1932 uprising. The images that circulated during this especially dramatic moment in São Paulo's history had their provenance in the decades prior to the outbreak of the actual civil war, at a time when Paulista elites exercised political dominance at the federal level, a dominance they energetically sought to naturalize through a set of narrative strategies. But I would also regard the constitutionalist campaign as itself a significant constitutive element in the construction of a particular Paulista identity. In other words, not only does this uprising reflect notions of Paulista superiority, but it becomes a context in which you get to define yourself as Paulista, and you get to try to define what it means to be Paulista. So this is a very crucial moment and in the formation of regional identity, and it also becomes a marker, your relationship to this uprising. Did you support it? Did you participate in it? Did your relatives participate in it? Become a marker of Paulista identity. Indeed, as, for example, the white Southerners' relationship to the Confederate Army. As one would expect, the campaign was a time of elaborate and heated defenses of Paulista superiority and unusually derogatory depictions of Brazilians from other regions and other races, with the two often being conflated. In fact, what I would argue is often when they're talking about Brazilians from other regions, they're really always talking about racially different, not just regionally different. And typically, when they're talking about Brazilians from other regions, they're really talking about the northeast of Brazil, an area that they regard, the Paulistas regard, as both correctly as the poorest region of Brazil, but also as non-white. And it's interesting, Getúlio Vargas, the man, the head of state who they're fighting against, is from the far south of Brazil, but he is increasingly equated with the northeast because much of his support comes in this period from the northeast of Brazil. As the conflict with the central government heated up during the early 1930s, essayists and polemicists shifted their preoccupations from the causes of São Paulo's difference to its political and cultural consequences, drawing liberally on social Darwinist theories regarding the suitability of different races for progress and modernity, as well as on apparently contradictory historical theories about the stages of civilization. And one of the things that's interesting in reading these documents is the way in which people would throw together explanations that were absolutely contradictory, but in a sense, they would just kind of pile them on. Paulista journalists and intellectuals celebrated the civic virtues of the regional population, which they attributed to its more civilized character. In speech after speech and essay after essay, Paulista writers from nearly every political camp extolled the civic and moral fiber of the povo bandeirante, the civilized and cultured character of the Paulista people, and the direct association between their region's stage of civilization and their concern for the rule of law, embodied in a demand for a constitution. And you can see in this poster that the soldier is holding a book called Lex, the Law. And so basically what the Paulistas argued is they embodied the rule of law because they were civilized, whereas the Northeasterners were unconcerned with the fact that Vargas's regime violated the rule of law because they were from an earlier stage of civilization that was not concerned with law and order. From early 1931 to the end of 1932, Paulistas, and especially those in the middling classes, were subjected to a barrage of newspaper articles, radio addresses, posters, poetry, music, maps, souvenirs, and other objects and images that reiterated these themes of São Paulo's superiority, modernity, and civic spirit. In the political writings that emerged in this period, the early 1930s and during the Civil War, there are frequent allusions to slavery usually along the lines of São Paulo or Brazil being enslaved by the Vargas dictatorship, or Brazil being reduced to a massive slave quarters. While this might seem at first glance as evidence of identification with the subaltern or the oppressed, I would argue that, on the contrary, it was meant to invoke with particular force the absurdity of the existing political situation in which cultured and civilized people were being subjected to treatment suitable only for Africans and other barbarians. And in many renditions, the humiliating nature of this situation was heightened by the role reversal it involved, whereby the degenerate descendants of the slave quarters, and I'll quote some documents, were imposing their will on the Europeanized and Christian people of São Paulo. Rather than drawing on a traditional anti-slavery discourse, these writers were deploying what I would call the trope of white slavery. And by white slavery, I mean an earlier notion of white slavery, not the, what we think of as prostitution, a sexual slave trade, but the earlier notion of white slavery, of the capturing of Europeans, for example, by Barbary pirates and their enslavement in North Africa. This trope of white slavery, with its outraged sense of the order of things being disrupted by the scandalous enslavement of those whose Christian and civilized nature, quote unquote, should have exempted them from the possibility of enslavement. Again, this theme appears almost constantly in the documentation produced to justify São Paulo's rebellion against the federal government. A priest whose radio broadcasts rallied popular support for the uprising declared in one address that just as, quote, Britons never shall be slaves, the Paulista has never been and will never be a slave, unquote. There were repeated references in speech and print to Vargas enslaving São Paulo and or Brazil, typically with the qualification that only the Paulistas actually objected to this enslavement, in contrast to the slavish hordes in other regions. Thus, the supposedly progressive Diario Nacional, one of the many newspapers in São Paulo at the time, accused Vargas's dictatorship of, quote, reducing Brazil to an African horde. Perhaps the most extreme expression of this sentiment can be found in a separatist manifesto issued soon after São Paulo surrendered to the federal forces. They're quickly defeated in this uprising. Although only a small segment of the Paulista population took up the separatist cause, I would argue that their ideas had considerable resonance within the constitutionalist movement and represented more than the views of a handful of extremists. The manifesto called for secession, for a São Paulo that would be better off as a, quote, small nation, rather than continue as mere, quote, mere associates of an unviable homeland, dominated by mestizos who have the souls of slaves and who are but one step removed from their ancestors whose bodies were enslaved both here and in Africa. You must defend, this is the manifesto, you must defend our patrimony against this barbarous horde that has spilled out from the north and the south, impelled by hunger and envy. The manifesto, unquote. The manifesto went on to describe these rapacious invaders as, quote, sons of the slave quarters and misery, victims of destructive climates, encrusted with the grossest ignorance, a people who are losing human form, such is the physical degeneration that ravages them, unquote. And it ends by denouncing the, quote, mestizos born of slaves, the foul offspring of the slave quarters, who now wish to enslave you, unquote. The manifesto is clearly drawing upon the trope of white slavery, portraying São Paulo's subordinate position within the Brazilian Federation as an abomination, an unnatural order in which the slaves have become masters, or the descendants of slaves have become masters, and the masters have become slaves. And lest we dismiss this explicitly racist screed as reflecting a minority position, we can point to the very similar imagery in many of the combat memoirs that were published after the Civil War. For example, that of Paulo Duarte, a leading figure in the supposedly progressive Partido Democrático, the Democratic Party. Duarte significantly entitled his account of his combat experience, Palmares pelo Avesso, Palmares in Reverse, And some of you may have heard of Palmares, a very famous 17th century runaway slave community that is estimated to have had anywhere between 8,000 and 20,000 people in it. And it was in the northeast of Brazil. And the Bandeirantes are credited with having been responsible for the final defeat of Palmares. So one of the Bandeirantes' great accomplishments is the defeat and destruction of the runaway slave community of Palmares. So this is Palmares in reverse, that is, the runaway slaves are invading and taking over São Paulo. In Duarte's memoirs, São Paulo's defeat by federal troops amounted to an invasion of the Bandeirantes' homeland by the degenerate descendants of the Palmarinos. Of course, white slavery is also a highly gendered trope, but I don't have time to go into that aspect of it today. But there were also a lot of discussion of how São Paulo was, for example, the favorite of Brazil, and that it was, and it referred to Brazil as Vargas's harem. But that, and in effect, what various writers said is the only reason São Paulo was not being raped by the Vargas regime was because of its impotence. So there was a lot of play with very explicit sexualization of the relationship between São Paulo and the federal government. I want to return as a sort of closing point to the issue of historical narrative and the representation of slavery as an element of São Paulo's emergence as Brazil's most prosperous region. Again, the repeated references to enslavement, far from reflecting a critical view of São Paulo's slave past or an acknowledgement of the sufferings and struggles of the slave labor force whose toil had made, arguably, São Paulo's initial surge of prosperity possible. This, instead, it constructed the true Paulista as the antithesis of the ex-slave. To say Paulistas had never been and never would be slaves when there were still many people living in São Paulo who had once been literally enslaved, and many more who were their immediate descendants, implied that the nature of Paulista character automatically excluded these ex-slaves and their descendants. Brazilians elsewhere might be characterized as spawn of the slave quarters, but not the true Paulista. Similarly, the standard narrative of abolition, with the enlightened Paulista planter bestowing freedom on his grateful chattel, reinforced the idea that those who had been enslaved had been the natural objects of enslavement, whereas Paulista soil was inhospitable to slavery as a way of life. It was white Paulistas' supposed distaste for slavery, not the efforts of the slaves themselves in this rendering of Paulista history, that brought about emancipation in this particular historical narrative. It should also be noted that this exclusion of the people of African descent from the category of Paulista was not usually replicated in the references to immigrants who poured into São Paulo after the abolition of slavery. Despite the rise of anti-immigrant sentiment in some quarters, there seems to have been a near universal embrace of the immigrant as a true Paulista during the constitutionalist campaign. In a sense, criticism of the immigrants tended to be focused on what they did, calling strikes, organizing unions, forming anarchist groups. But such criticism did not question whether the immigrants, in their very essence, could become part of the Povo Bandeirante. In contrast, the exclusion of people of African descent stemmed not from any specified actions or behaviors on their part, but from their essential nature. Thus, the pro-constitutionalist literature repeatedly assured the Paulista public that, quote, there are no foreigners here, unquote, and claimed that the immigrant communities were avidly taking up the causa Paulista, the Paulista cause. Paulista writers regularly recognized immigration as a crucial element of São Paulo's modernity, whereas immigrants from Africa and their descendants were represented as remnants of an anomalous episode from the past. And I want to just end by showing you one image from the 1932 uprising. And it's a particularly historically a particularly interesting image, because obviously this is a drawing. It's done by a very well-known artist and cartoonist named Belmonte. It was very popular in this period. And what it depicts is an episode during the 1932 uprising where Paulistas were asked to donate their gold. It was called the Campaña de Oro, the gold campaign. They were asked to donate their gold to finance the war against the federal government. And so it depicts all kinds, quote unquote, of Paulistas contributing their gold to the campaign. And there is some attempt at diversity in this drawing. So there are clearly some men and women who are from the upper, the very middle and upper class. There are some, that little boy on the side, I think is supposed to be a little boy from the working class. But what is striking about this is the only drawing I've found that clearly depicts a Paulista or somebody in São Paulo of African descent. But what you can notice about him is that he's very old. He's one person, he's very old, he represents the least threatening depiction of an Afro-Paulista, and he's clearly someone who's fading from the historical scene. The little boy on the side, who's the son of a European immigrant, is the future of São Paulo, but the elderly black man clearly represents a now receding and soon to be completely obliterated past. And so I think in this very design, even as it acknowledges the presence of people of African descent in Paulista society, it also is in the process of erasing them. Thank you.